I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. On Wednesday, President Trump announced his support for a new Senate bill called the RAISE Act that would drastically cut legal immigration to this country, moving from a more family-based system to one based on merit or specific skills to get a green card.
The RAISE Act ends chain migration and replaces our low-skilled system with a new points-based system for receiving a green card. This competitive application process will favor applicants who can speak English, financially support themselves and their families, and demonstrate skills that will contribute to our economy. The RAISE Act prevents new migrants and new immigrants from collecting welfare and protects U.S. workers from being displaced. And that's a very big thing. They're not going to come in and just immediately go and collect welfare. That doesn't happen under the RAISE Act. They can't do that.
We asked Harry Holzer to join us. He's a professor at the McCourt School of Public Policy at Georgetown University. He's also a non-resident senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution and was chief economist for the U.S. Department of Labor. Harry Holzer, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. It's nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. If the RAISE Act were passed, and apparently that's a gigantic if, what impact would it have on the U.S. economy?
It would restrict the flow of legal immigrants. That's probably a bad idea right now when labor markets are tight, baby boomers are retiring, we could use those extra workers. It might generate some very modest increases in wages for some groups in the short term, like less educated folks. But over time, the positive effects would be very modest. And like I said, it would reduce the size of the labor force, which right now would be a negative.
Would it affect more dramatically people at this sort of the more upper end of our economy in that it makes English, for instance, a requirement?
You know, it's not necessarily a bad idea to emphasize labor market skill. But the way this bill does it is a bad idea. We get lots of graduate students from Asia and other places whose English is not very good, and yet they often choose to stay and make important contributions to the economy. So I think it would make it harder even for those folks to enter our labor market and to get a green card. And that's particularly troubling because those folks contribute a lot to the economy, and there's very little disagreement about that.
You said we need immigration and or immigrants, and it seems that most economists agree with that. Is that because you've got baby boomers retiring and you've got, a shrinking workforce?
You know, that's one of the reasons that right now it's a particularly bad time to restrict immigration. I mean, even aside from the baby boomer retirements, immigrants do make some contributions to the U.S. economy and workforce, especially the high-skilled immigrants. You know, the high-skilled immigrants get a lot of patents. They create a lot of business startups. So they generally are very good for the economy. The less-skilled immigrants do compete at least a little bit with native-born high school dropouts, high school graduates. But on the other hand, they lower prices in a lot of key industries like agriculture and housing and healthcare, and that's a big positive. So even under any circumstances, separate from baby boomers, immigrants do make some contributions to the economy, especially at the high end. But now the baby boomer retirements make it a particularly bad time to restrict this flow. You know, the baby boomers are going to leave the workforce. It's going to be harder for employers to find workers. And there's going to be fewer taxpayers over time to help pay the taxes that pay for the Social Security and Medicare that the baby boomers are going to get. And that's a huge burden on our tax system. Bringing more people in simply helps us pay that. And that's a very important contribution right now that immigrants will make.
Well, I know a couple of countries, Australia, Canada, do use a merit-based system. I don't know how close it is to the RAISE Act. But again, if this were passed, and again, this is apparently a great big if, it does shift from skills or merit to skills and merit away from family. Is there any way to know about the impact that would have on our U.S. economy?
You know, again, I'm not opposed to some shift away from family in the direction of skill. Not necessarily really dramatic, but some shift along those lines. The problem with the RAISE Act is that it's so severe that even highly skilled immigrants lacking in these particular categories would have a hard time. You know, like I said, people with engineering degrees or PhDs from parts of Asia or parts of East Europe would have a hard time making it in because of the language requirements. So to me, it's not the idea that we're having some skill requirements. It's the particularly restrictive nature of the requirements in this bill. So it would be harder. It would be harder for foreigners to enter the country. It would be harder for employers to find trained engineers and scientists. And certainly that would be disruptive in the short run. But over the long run, it would restrict the number of patents we generate, the number of businesses that start up, and that would be pretty negative for everybody.
I've heard the argument that if you cut immigration, it will result in increased wages, especially for people at the low end of the economic spectrum. Is that true?
I think it's probably true for people at the low end, but the question is how much. And to me, the studies suggest that it's a quite modest effect. Especially over time, because over time, the economy has all kinds of ways of adjusting to that, what economists call the longer run. So in the short run, overall, people might get a modest raise, and over time, even that would dissipate somewhat. So true, but small in magnitude.
Let me quote something. This comes from Senator Perdue. He's from Georgia. He says, our current system does not work. It keeps America from being competitive and does not meet the needs of our economy today. Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican, also, he of course, South Carolina, says, if this proposal were to become law, it would be devastating to our state's economy, which relies on this immigrant workforce. Hotels, restaurants, golf courses, and farmers will tell you this proposal to cut legal immigration in half would put their business in peril. Are they both right? Are they both wrong?
I think they're both talking about different parts of the immigration system. My guess is that what Senator Perdue was talking about was that on average we need more, relatively more highly skilled immigrants, and the current system doesn't reward high skill. I think what Senator Graham was talking about is that all of these restrictions would really put businesses in a bind that currently rely a lot on these workers, and especially the unskilled immigrants. And there's some truth to both of those. I lean a little closer to Senator Graham's point of view. In the short term, it would be very, very disruptive to have a large drop in immigration at either end of the skill spectrum.
Is there any way to know whether hotels, restaurants, golf courses would rather hire immigrants than American-born workers?
Well, there's two issues. Number one, would the employers rather hire the immigrants? And number two, would the workers be willing to take those jobs? I think that at the very low end, employers probably do have some preference for immigrants. I think immigrants from some of these countries, if you're talking about jobs that don't involve the use of the English language, don't involve any math skill, immigrants can do those jobs very well, and they're often very happy to have the work, and they're very reliable workers. American native-born workers in those jobs know that they're very low wage and are not very happy to have the jobs and often turn over in very large numbers. So for that very unskilled work, employers probably do have some preference for immigrants. But the question is whether American workers are willing to take those jobs. The answer in many cases is that they won't be willing to take them at the current wage level. Now, employers would then have to start bidding up wages to get American workers to take those jobs. But what's even more likely to happen is the job would likely disappear. Employers would figure out other ways to get the work done, maybe with some new technology. Maybe they would offer fewer services than they offer right now. So at the end of the day, not that many more workers, especially over time, would fill those jobs.
Of course, that raises the question about, so where does any policy, whether it's the RAISE Act or any policy related to our economy and jobs, where does that leave then the low-wage worker? How do we help them?
Well, that's the important question. It's very important to help these workers. Economists would generally say a whole range of factors have hurt those workers in America: technology, imports, some policy choices like minimum wages, not keeping up with inflation. We need to commit to doing more for those workers. I think the most important way to help them over time is to help those workers get more education, especially in the fields where there's strong demand in the economy, healthcare, advanced manufacturing, IT, transportation and logistics, the high end of retail. Those are all places where if we give workers more of these skills, they'll be able to get better paying jobs over time. And then we could do some supportive things as well, like raise the minimum wage moderately. I support going to $10. I don't support going to $15, making sure everybody has health insurance, et cetera. So it's very, very important to help those workers. This is the RAISE Act is really not the best way to do it.
You just slipped in, make sure everyone has health insurance, which, of course, is something we have not been able to do in this country. That's critical to ensuring that we have a well-paid and productive workforce.
I think health care is a critically important service. You know, my brother would be to have some kind of universal coverage. I think the Affordable Care Act was a very sizable step in that direction, and I'm glad that it hasn't been repealed or replaced.
We just got some job numbers today. For the month of July, 209,000 jobs. Unemployment, the official unemployment rate in the U.S. is 4.3%. What do you make of those numbers?
They're good numbers. It means that the labor market continues to hum along. That was true towards the end of the Obama administration. It continues to be true in the Trump administration. That's a good thing. We are at or near what most economists consider to be full employment. Again, so it's a bad time to cut back on people who want to work, where there's jobs that are sometimes hard to fill. There are some problems in that labor market, especially longer-term problems. A lot of people, especially less educated men, have dropped out of the labor force. We need to help them get back in. Mm-hmm. Wages are too low, and they're going up too slowly. Productivity needs to grow more. So it's a good, solid report, but it does leave some longer-term challenges that we still need to address.
Almost up in a break here. I'm always curious about when a previous president's economy ends and the current president's economy begins and when you get to take credit and when you get the blame.
There's one or two areas where I think President Trump would get some credit, and that's mostly true in the stock market. There has clearly been a Trump effect on the stock market, and there seems to have been a rise in confidence and in expectations that he'll cut regulations, cut taxes, and do other things that business people like. My guess is that over the long run, some of that bump will dissipate. But in all other aspects of the real economy, employment, wages, productivity, everything you've seen in the last 6 months is pretty much a continuation of what was already happening before the election.
And that's Harry Holzer, our guest in this portion of Radio Times, talking about a plan put forth by Republican senators, both Tom Cotton and David Perdue, and endorsed by the president, having a more merit-based immigration system. What do you think? 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And I'm talking with Harry Holzer, professor at the McCourt School of Public Policy at Georgetown University. He's a non-resident senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution and served as chief economist for the U.S. Labor Department, talking about a plan outlined earlier this week, the RAISE Act, that would change our immigration system to a more merit-based system. And again, you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Harry, what happens to immigrants after, let's say, the first generation, broadly speaking?
They tend to integrate into the U.S. economy and U.S. society quite well. The data show that on average, two generations later, that they've caught up with American workers in education and in earnings. That's not necessarily true of every single group. Some groups take a little longer, but it's true on average. And, of course, some groups, especially some more educated groups from Asia, actually tend to outperform the native-born a few generations later. But in general, they tend to integrate quite well.
And what has been the effect, or do we know the effect, of the rhetoric, frankly, the anti-immigrant rhetoric that we've heard from the president, both as a more as a candidate, probably then as president of the United States, but has that kept immigrants out of the country?
I don't know that we have good data on this yet, or at least I haven't seen the numbers. I think the number of illegal immigrants coming from Mexico had already grown very small. My sense is that there's been a further decline in the number of people certainly coming illegally. I would guess that there's been some drop in legal entrants as well, because they just the rhetoric from Donald Trump has been so harsh. My guess is that they see the United States as having a less hospitable climate for immigration. So I haven't seen really hard numbers on that, but I would guess there's been some decline.
Let me read some comments. We just got a tweet. Case in point, Kennett Square, the mushroom capital of the world, still number one because of our immigrating Latino workforce. And certainly in agriculture, Harry, we see a lot of immigrants working in agriculture, in farming.
Yeah, so farming is that classic kind of job that, number one, is very heavily dependent on immigrants right now, and number two, the American workers really aren't going to take absent really, really large wage increases that would probably put those firms out of business. So that's a sector where, number one, they're very dependent right now. It would be very, very disruptive to that industry to have a really large crackdown on low-skilled immigrants. Number two, over time, the industry would adapt. They'd have more mechanization. They'd raise wages somewhat, but it would certainly hurt the industry in the short run.
An email from Joan who says, I've heard that we're experiencing a brain drain of some of our high-tech and senior scientist types because of our commitment to fossil fuels. They're going to where the jobs are in alternative energy. Other countries are recognizing and valuing those skills. Can your guest address that issue? Have you looked at that specifically?
That's a little bit of a separate issue from immigration. My guess is that highly skilled PhDs, whether they're native born or immigrants, who really want to work on alternative energy, may be going elsewhere or are staying here and studying other things. I tend to agree with the caller that it's bad policy. My guess is it doesn't have an enormous effect on the flows and destinations of immigrants.
And what do you think the impact has been on the fact that we have something like 11, maybe 12 million immigrants who are undocumented in this country, and we cannot seem, as a political system and a country, to come to some kind of consensus on immigration reform, what to do with these millions of people, and how to have a system that allows immigrants into the country that serves everybody?
That remains the biggest casualty of our failure to come up with comprehensive immigration reform. You know, in 2013, there was a bipartisan bill that passed the Senate with a vote of 68-32, and then it died in the House. But
right.
Yeah, you have these immigrants. As people say, they live in the shadows. That restricts their ability to get better paying jobs and to do other things, and it's bad for their kids. As well, and that's why the moves that the Obama administration made without legislation to try to help the Dreamers or the parents of citizens, I think we're a good step in the right direction. But we really do need a comprehensive bill, and it's bad for those people, and especially for their children, to keep them living in this limbo situation.
Let me get Nancy from Newtown to join our conversation. Nancy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi.
Hi there.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just wondering why we can't have job training programs and education for people in this country, especially for technical jobs. It seems there's a lot of technical people in this country that could do that work, but they keep bringing in people from other countries.
Mm.
And also, I just wanted to make a comment that I think the unemployment rate that they go by today is really unrealistic. There's a lot more than 4.5% unemployed and underemployed, and I'm one of them. I'll take my answer
sure.
off the air. Thank you.
Appreciate the call, Nancy. Thanks for calling in to Radio Times. Harry, you want to respond?
Well, yes. So on the second point that Nancy made, she's right in some way. The official number of 4.3% does leave a lot of people out, people who are working part-time or at a low-wage job when their skills are better, or people have stopped looking altogether. We have those alternative rates. They're in the Labor Department report every month. They just don't get as much press as the big number. But she's largely right about that.
I'm curious, what are those rates when you add everyone all together?
Well, you know, the Labor Department has six different unemployment rates that it looks at. The largest one that includes everybody, including people like Nancy, you know, is in the range of 9 to 10%.
Okay.
You know, and it's always at least double what the official rate is. So that's always true. Those numbers are there, and they probably deserve to get a little more press than they do. But on Nancy's first point, yes, we have technical workers and engineers in the United States. We still bring in these foreign workers. There's a big debate about whether the native-born folks with engineering degrees have the right, the specific technical skills, and at a high enough level for what the tech industry is looking for. You know, the tech industry wants the very best talent to maximize its productivity. They claim that in many cases the foreign-born workers can meet those needs better than the native-born workers. I think there are problems with what we call the H-1B system. That's the system where we bring in these foreign workers and they're sort of tethered to a specific company that lets them in, and that enables them to be exploited for low wages. I think it's fair for countries to want some of that foreign flow. That system could use some update and some reform.
Well, we're going to end on that note. Harry Holzer, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Our pleasure as well. Professor of Public Policy at Georgetown, non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Well, the Black Star Film Festival, whose tagline is "By Indie Means Necessary," is underway in Philadelphia. Ebony Magazine has called the four-day festival the Black Sundance, showcasing films by and about people of color. This year, the theme is resistance, with more than 60 films being screened at locations in West Philadelphia at International House, the Institute of Contemporary Art, and Drexel University's Pearlstein Gallery. Interestingly, the festival has coincided with the announcement that HBO is in the process of producing a series called Confederate that imagines the South has won the Civil War, it has seceded from the North, and slavery still exists. It has sparked the hashtag campaign No Confederate, calling for the series to be canceled because of the involvement of the Game of Thrones executive producers, both white men, and the subject matter. By the way, the two other writers and executive producers are African-American, Nichelle Tramble Spellman and Malcolm Spellman. Well, lots to talk about, and we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Mayuri Carmel Holmes is curator, filmmaker, and founder of the Black Star Film Festival. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. Nice
You're
to
welcome.
Be here.
Nice to have you with us. Michael Primo is a multidisciplinary artist. He's a journalist and a filmmaker, co-founder and executive producer at Storyline. And Michael, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, clearly shifting gears here, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Mayuri, this Black Star Film Festival goes back, what, 5 years?
This is our sixth year.
Sixth year.
Yes.
What was the genesis? What was the thinking behind the very first one?
So I started the festival by accident.
Did you?
I intended to do a micro festival focusing on Africa for one day, because in 2012 we recognized, you know, sort of like Black August was happening and there were all these anniversaries and independences that were to be celebrated.
And now you've got a four-day festival with 60
yes.
films.
Yeah, that first year we ended up with 40 films, and so many people came. Even that year, people came from all over the world to attend their screenings and things like that. And then Ebony said that Black Sundance thing the first year. And so immediately after, people were like, when's the next one?
And the theme, or I guess a theme this year, an important theme this year, is resistance.
Yes. That theme emerged after we saw the submissions that were coming in. Nihad Kader, who's our senior program manager, she just kind of wrote to me and she said, I think this is the theme. We hadn't really set one out when we were looking for work. We knew we wanted to show Whose Streets. We knew we were going to show Wilmington 10.
Right.
But then all these other films started coming in that were about police, you know, and vigilante violence. And then there were also, you know, resistance within families around queer identity and all these other elements.
Does that surprise you that ended up being the theme?
I don't think so. I mean, I think we've had a fairly political bent the entire time. And then just given what's going on right now, it's not surprising.
No, no. And I do want to talk about all of that. Michael, I know you were part of a panel yesterday mm-hmm. about the stories we tell. Or who gets to tell our story, right?
Yeah, yeah. We had a really really interesting conversation with a packed house of people at the ICA, really kind of digging into this massive conversation of who gets to tell whose stories and what does cultural appropriation really mean?
Well, and you're a documentary filmmaker, right?
That's correct.
In part, you do a number of things. So in many ways, you get to tell people's stories, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it was having this conversation at a film festival is a prime place to have this conversation because filmmakers, you know, even when you're talking about filmmakers of color, black filmmakers may be telling stories of other black communities that are not their own cultural or national heritage, right? And so my work, I have a short film in the festival called Water Warriors, which is at Sunday at 11 a.m., and it's a story of an indigenous community in New Brunswick, Canada. I am not indigenous, and I'm not from Canada.
So how do you approach something like that, knowing that this, you're obviously interested in the story, but you're not of this story, if I can put it that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think I approach my work with a very particular analysis of power and the history, the legacy of colonialism and the legacy of genocide and how these things have affected subsequent generations, how trauma is transmitted from generation to generation. And when working on Water Warriors in New Brunswick, Canada, which is just north of Maine, mm-hmm. before we picked up a camera, we asked permission of the elders if it was okay, if we could come into their community and document their story. And we approached the situation as though the people directly affected by whatever the topic, the issue is, are the experts best positioned mm-hmm. to provide that analysis and commentary, and that guides our work.
Mary, what do you make of this hashtag No Confederate?
It's really interesting. I went to high school in the South, and I often would have a kind of low tolerance for this idea that the North or the Union were the saviors, because I know that Lincoln and everyone else, you know, he said, if I could keep this country together and not free the slaves, I would. So my, you know, sort of hate for the Confederacy is not as deep. However, I want to be really careful with that, because I don't think that our bodies, like black bodies, matter to either side. Beyond labor. So I wanted to be really careful about that. But I do think this kind of revisionist fantasy about slavery not ending is mm-hmm. troubling. And so I understand the hashtag, and I understand why people are upset with all the things that we could be creating right now. Why would we want to see this as a vision? And so I think it's interesting that at the same time, recently, Aaron Magruder and Will Packer have now released, I think Amazon is going to distribute the opposite story.
Oh, interesting.
So what if black people would receive reparations? So not only freedom, but we're compensated for their toil. So I think it's a, I usually am on the side of allow artists to create what they need to create. But in this case, it does seem troubling that at this moment, with all of the things that we've been dealing with in the news, with death and all these uprisings, that people would want to tell this story. It's really, really troubling.
Let me quote a couple of things. This is Malcolm Spellman, and this is from an NPR interview. He says, and he's one of the executive producers, one of the writers as well, first thing to tell everybody is what this project is not. The project is not antebellum imagery. It's not whips. It's not plantations. It's not a celebration or pornography for slavery. And most important, it's not an entire nation of slaves. And then the writer Eric Deggans goes on to say that the series will likely feature an America divided, where the South has a system that looks like an apartheid South Africa. The goal, they say, is to show how today's problems with racial issues, over policing of black people, disenfranchisement through voter ID laws, lack of representation at the highest levels of power, is rooted in the nation's legacy of slavery. I mean, this is obviously a very complicated issue, and we're talking about something that nobody has seen, but it seems they're trying to connect what we're dealing with today with the legacy of slavery. Does that?
Well, but what he's saying exists. So we don't need a film to show that. We know we saw the 13th. You know, we read the new Jim Crow. We know that these things are connected. I'm not sure why we would need a fictional series. I mean, we have The Wire. Like, we don't need another sort of showing, I think, of kind of the pathology of blackness in the country.
You think that's what it is?
Well, that's what that statement sounds like. I mean, I don't really know too much about, other than what's been going around on Twitter, but that statement feels like that's what they're trying to show. And I think that a lot of people saw saw the 13th, which is a wonderful, you know, tool to show those connections. So I'm not sure that this fictional film by people who make Game of Thrones, all I can imagine is the kind of sensationalism that will be present. So
because of Game of Thrones?
I mean, I think that's what people are reacting to about who the creators are who are making this.
What do you think, Michael?
Yeah, I think so, too. I mean, I'm hesitant to, you know, I fully support sort of creativity and artistic expression, and I think that's something that is critical as part of this conversation. But that being said, I also am not interested in slave. I'm exhausted by slave narratives. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think I'm really kind of excited about the counter, which is Black America, which mm-hmm. is... I think what something that's troubling about this particular approach is that it doesn't free ourselves from the imagination of the legacy of slavery, which is really interesting about Black America, the Aaron Magruder piece, because potentially it can free us from, okay, what would it look like if slavery either hadn't happened or if it had happened, there was reparations and Black people got a sovereign nation. What would that look like, and how robust and dynamic might the society be? I think that frees us from this sort of like being in the sort of alley way that we find ourselves in, you know?
About a minute from our break here, I'm thinking though, in an argument in any kind of way, but the numbers of films that have made about the Holocaust, for instance.
Absolutely.
You know, it's trying to, in a sense, juxtapose, even though, of course, two very different parts of our history.
Mm-hmm. And there's the Philip K. Dick book, which is, you know, Man in the High Castle, which imagine the World War II one, you know. Mm-hmm. And there are other Confederate stories that Kevin Wilmot, who is a Black man who wrote and directed a film called CSA, Confederate States of America, which was a mockumentary of a British documentary crew coming to the Confederate USA and interrogating the situation. So there is a history of these sort of imaginations.
Absolutely. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Michael Primo. He's a multidisciplinary artist. He's a journalist, a filmmaker, co-founder, and executive producer of Storyline. Also with us, Mayuri Carmel Holmes, and she's a curator, filmmaker, founder of the Black Star Film Festival, underway in Philadelphia through the weekend. And in fact, on Saturday, she'll be hosting a discussion with Academy Award nominated filmmaker and entrepreneur and activist Ava DuVernay. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499 to join our conversation. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with Michael Primo and Mayuri Carmel Holmes about the hashtag No Confederate. Also talking about the kind of approach that filmmakers probably should have when approaching a story, especially one that is perhaps not part of their own experience and their own life. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. I know you're talking with Ava DuVernay, and she's going to be directing A Wrinkle in Time for Disney mm-hmm. for more than $100 million. Mm-hmm. What does that tell us?
I think it's amazing. It tells us what a force that she is. I mean, we had Ava at our first festival in 2012 when not that many people knew her outside of Black Film Festival circuits. And I'd also met her at a previous festival that I'd done for women in 2008 with her very first film. And so it's really incredible to me that in a very short time period that she's now, you know, the most, I think, Academy Award nominated Black filmmaker. And, you know, for women, it's also very rare. So she's just such a force. It's amazing.
Do you see parallels between this No Confederate hashtag and Hollywood So White? Do you see parallels there?
I don't know that I see a parallel. I think what's really powerful about, you know, Twitter is that people are able to, you know, express opinions very quickly.
Yes, they do.
And sort of, quickly. You know, in an aggregate way with hashtags, and people can join in. Sometimes it's really fast. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think we don't have an opportunity for nuance. I think that Hollywood So White is different than No Confederate. The only similarities I'd say was just the speed with which they happened.
Yes.
I think Hollywood So White is a real problem. No Confederate is also a problem, but I think it's a very specific one. It's about this particular project as opposed to an industry and a structure.
I'm thinking of Hidden Figures of last year, and of course Moonlight. Is that from your perspective at least an incremental sign of progress?
I wouldn't say it's an incremental sign. I mean, for one, Hidden Figures starred Black people. I don't know, to my knowledge, people behind the scenes, the director, the producer, the editor, I don't know that the writers or any of those people were of mm-hmm. color. So that, to me, is where the power is. I love those actors, and I'm glad that they had that opportunity. But I also, I'm 39 years old. I remember the 90s boom. I remember a similar boom in the mid-2000s. I mean, I feel like when we see a longer shift, when we no longer notice the shifts of these films, then that's a real change. And I think there's also a real change when we're not just talking about Black people and our opportunities, because there are also Arab people and Indigenous people and South Asian people and, Latinos, and just so many people are not seen. And so I think when we can't notice, then that's when the real change happens.
Sure, Michael. Anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, what I'm really excited about is when there's diverse representation from multiple groups in who are greenlighting projects, who are executives, who are producers behind the camera. I think that's when we'll see the change.
Well, I should add that the new film Detroit opens today. It's about an incident of civil racial unrest going back to the 1960s in Detroit, led to something like more than 40 people died, more than 1,000 injuries. The director is Catherine Bigelow. The writer, Mark Boll. They are both white. What's your thought about that, Michael, in the context of what we were just talking about?
I haven't seen it yet.
Me neither.
So, but I've heard a lot about it. I've read a bunch about it. And, I think one of the glaring omissions is the omission of Black women that seems apparent from the narrative, which, talk about, a group of people that are continually erased from history, continually erased from the conversation when their contribution is integral and undeniable. And so when you have such an undeniable presence, so visibly not represented, it becomes glaring. I think it's troublesome, particularly for someone like Catherine Bigelow, who, I don't know much about her, but someone who presents as breaking through glass ceilings in her own right, to not have that perspective is troubling.
She's quoted as saying, I'm a white person, and wondering out loud. Obviously, she made the film, but she said, am I the right person to do this? Michael Eric Dyson was also quoted, and he apparently was a consultant on the film. And this is something in the New York Times. He said, this is a white woman telling the truth as much as she can on film about racial injustice in America. That will resonate very powerfully with white folks. What better way to use your white privilege than to undermine it, raise questions about it, leverage it on the half of Black and brown people who usually don't have a voice in the matter at all. I know Michael Eric Dyson. What do you make of that, Mary?
I think it's something, I think that's one part of it. I think there's several ways to be an ally. Another way to be an ally, something that I've learned from folks at the Leeway Foundation, is to give up your seat at the table. If you're really considering that other people might tell a story, that you provide that opportunity for them, or, you leave the table. I think oftentimes we talk about access, but we're not thinking about removing ourselves from the equation for whatever privilege we might hold. And so I think that's one of those cases, to ask yourself, am I the right person to tell the story? I don't know what she thought the answer was, but if she didn't think she was and told it anyway, I think that's, possibly a problem. Or if someone else could tell it, better, someone from Detroit, perhaps, or something like that.
You think someone... I mean, which of course raises a question, something you mentioned earlier, Michael, just can you tell someone else's story?
Well, I think that you can. I think that there are lots of ways to consider that. There's a hip-hop activist named Rock Goddess that I think about often, and she says, when you're putting in the work, in a particular community. I mean, I think that we all are have interest, and we are all storytellers, and so I don't think that there's no flat, there's no black and white, like you can't tell this story because you're not of that community. But, I think the example that Michael gave of asking permission of the elders, where have you situated yourself in a story before you tell it? How are you connecting to it?
Which is complicated, mm-hmm. obviously. I mean, you can do research and you can try to be as open-minded as you can, but then we've got our own prejudices, our own barriers, our own stereotypes. Mm-hmm. How do you wrestle with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think those things are inherent, but I think in a situation, The larger issue also is that, you know, Hollywood is notorious for butchering historical stories, changing facts, adjusting things in the so-called interest of the sort of narrative structure. But I think that, like, there's an opportunity. We've been having this conversation for as long as Hollywood has been around. I think there is – I think it's an easy way out. It's the sort of marketing, sort of corporate approach. It's a cop-out. I think we can tell stories that are more historically accurate, more in line with what actually happened and still make powerful stories. I mean, Moonlight is a perfect example of telling a really complicated, nuanced, emotionally centered story about people who are never in the center. Right.
And for on almost all levels.
All levels, right? So it's a perfect example that, like, in a historical fiction story, why we couldn't get that right, you know, which, in my opinion, is far less nuanced, you know?
I was thinking of the film Get Out. I don't know why. I mean, just because I loved it so much. But and it's kind of a sci-fi horror story. What did you think? You laughed.
I thought Get Out was a brilliant film. I mean, technically, there was no fat. I mean, it was like just sort of nothing was wasted. I mean, it was really, really amazing. It's also been, you know, giving me nightmares when I find myself in an all-white
situation.
Scary white
people, right?
Yeah, upstate New York or something like that. So, I mean, I thought it was great. And I think it was, you know, it was interesting to see the film in an all-white theater. And then it was also interesting to see it in an all-black theater.
Oh, and what was the difference?
Very different experience.
What was the difference?
What people laugh at. What they find uncomfortable or what they find funny. And, you know, it's a real privilege to be able to do things like that. But I thought the film was really done well because it wasn't, you know, it was all psychological. And, you know, it was great.
Used satire and humor and scary things. And I saw it in what I would describe as a mixed theater. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it seems to me, I mean, that's one of the joys of going to the movies is sharing it with an audience of largely strangers.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's right. And I think relevant to this conversation, too, the ending is really interesting where, you know, and I've heard his conversation where he chose a different ending where there was an unhappy ending, but he thought that after everything that happened, no, this guy needed to get out. His friend needed to come. We needed a happy ending. And I think that's a really beautiful example of telling a story with responsibility to an audience and a broader community. Mm-hmm. And that demonstrates accountability, which I think is often missing from this conversation, is the necessity of being accountable to the impacted community who's affected by the issues that the story brings up.
I'm curious, Michael, how you pick and choose the stories that you want to tell. I mean, what do you feel comfortable telling? Obviously, a documentary about Indigenous people is one story.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I'm interested sort of broadly in my body of work. I'm interested in stories that create connection among different groups of people, which really sort of strike at the aspirations of individuals and the resiliency of the human spirit. And I'm interested in going to places to find stories that are outside of the mainstream, that are sort of marginalized from those conversations, so we can push them towards the mainstream of sort of dominant conversations. And that's really what excites me.
I mean, we talk about being in this golden age of television. Do you think we are to some degree in movies as well, or is that a different criteria, Maori?
I'm not sure if we're in a golden age of movies in the way that we are with television. I mean, there's so much prestige television at the moment on all of these emerging.
Almost overwhelming.
It's almost overwhelming. And a lot of it, but the wonderful thing about the television shows that I'm not seeing reflected in the films is the diversity, right? Like, we've got Master of None, we have Atlanta, we have Insecure, you know, we have Transparent. We have these different communities that are being reflected in really high production value, really excellent cast. And I'm not seeing that in the film space necessarily. So I don't feel like we're in that golden age just yet. But maybe Moonlight will set a precedence for people to take gambles on these other stories.
Do you think Hollywood movies, they're just more conservative or just slower to, you know, turn the ocean liner around?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think there's more money at stake, right? You know, there's the marketing of the projects, what they expect for them to do overseas and things like that. But I do think that Netflix and Amazon are shaking that up. Yep. So I'll be curious to see what they do in the theatrical space, similar to what they've been doing in the quote television space.
A tweet from Johnson who says, what do you think of the Amazon show The Man in the High Castle, which imagines that the Axis powers, Germany and Japan, won the Second World War, and the United States is essentially under occupation. not dissimilar from Confederate. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, not dissimilar. I watched the first season. I haven't read the book. I understand the book like
Philip
a
K.
book.
Dick. Yeah,
the Philip K. Dick novel is much more nuanced than the film, than the TV show was able to be. But I think it's also relevant to the conversation, also talking about people who deny that the Holocaust exists. Right. And, you know, in that first season, that narrative, there was no sort of there was just allusions to what we know in real life was the sort of aspiration of the cleansing that the Nazi Party was trying to do. But it completely kind of erased that history. And I think that's significant to this conversation.
Because you didn't see Auschwitz, you didn't see the ovens, any of that.
Yeah. And there was no real conversation about racial purity necessarily. That was just assumed. Right. And so I think that in some ways that kind of erases the history and sort of feeds into these conversations about the denial of the Holocaust.
You think it actually gave fodder to people that would deny it or say it wasn't as bad as...
I don't know if I could be as bold to say it gave fodder, but like thinking about particularly young people, and I've been thinking about this a lot lately, thinking about a generation of young people who maybe were kind of coming of age when, you know, Donald Trump was screaming his racist nonsense and the birther movement was born. Like, these things all permeate the minds of and shape people, right? And so it's hard to say if any other one particular thing has that impact, but certainly as an aggregate, without a doubt, they sort of feed these sort of like racist and, you know, stereotypes.
You mentioned the fact, Maori, that the resistance is the theme of the Black Star Film Festival. What did you look for? You mentioned the Wilmington 10, but what did you look for in the kind of films that you wanted to present?
We're really interested in expanding people's expectations of what I think, I hesitate to say black film, but what black filmmakers can do. So all the time, we're always looking for things that are, you know, kind of breaking genre, that are technically really excellent, but that are also doing things. Sometimes it's simple as having a dark-skinned woman be the lead in a romance. Mm-hmm. You know, that's something we almost never see before Insecure. You know, like, that's not something that's in the mainstream. So, you know, there's all these multiple ways, you know, if there's, you know, alternative families that are represented, or if there's the one of the things that happens in Wilmington 10, and this is from 1979, but is that the people are not identified the way you would in a documentary, and so it forces you to take everyone seriously.
Oh, that's so,
it's
so
like
interesting.
This little thing that shifts the power in the film. So where it's always this combination of kind of politics and the aesthetics and trying to show the diversity of blackness. I mean, that's really ultimately our goal. And so, you know, this year we have a film about drag culture, and we have a film about, you know, it's kind of like a queer dating site, you know, in LA. And like, you can't be more different than those things, but it's just trying to be multi-generational, trying to be national, I mean, international,
sure.
And showing different countries as much as possible. We show a lot of experimental work. So we're really just trying to, like, I think, go beyond what's in the mainstream.
And can you sit back and enjoy everything while the festival is going on? Or
not at all. I've never been to the festival. I have no idea.
You've never been to your own festival.
No. I mean, there's lots of work that still is happening.
Sure,
you know,
so. Sure. So how's the festival going then, Michael?
The festival has been great. I mean, I go to a lot of festivals, and this is probably one of my favorite. I mean, the camaraderie and the quality of the films, and films that are very hard to see in other places. I mean, it's really a testament to the curation.
And how did you get into your line of work?
How did I get it? So I come out of the theater. I produced theater for years and years, downtown New York theater with the Hip Hop Theater Festival and other organizations. And I was a photojournalist. And I started working with Dave Isay in StoryCorps. And that really kind of put me on my path of creating sort of more documentary-centered media. And from there, I moved to film and a bunch of different media.
But hearing people tell their own stories, I mean, that is what StoryCorps is about.
At the essential, like traveling around the country, listening to people share their most intimate details about their lives and the things they wanted to preserve, had a profound impact on my path.
You can't listen to StoryCorps and not cry. I'm just saying.
Yep.
Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Michael Primo, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
You're very welcome. And Mayori Carmel Holmes, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much
You're
for having
very
me.
Welcome. I should say that at 3 o'clock this afternoon, tune into Facebook Live from Newsworks and WHYY at the Black Star Film Festival that goes through Sunday. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Great. Go to I just lost my way there. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. You can sign up for our newsletter as well. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.